This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. We have a lot of news to get to. And for that, we're going to turn to the Times Union, checking in with Times Union's Philip Pantuso, heading up the Hudson Valley Bureau. Philip, thank you for joining us once again here on the local edition.
Always good to be with you.
So I want to start quick with following up on a story that we covered at the beginning of the week, which is this the EEE, the encephalitis, the equine encephalitis, has essentially jumped to people. And no sooner did we learn about this case infecting someone in Ulster County than we heard of their passing. You want to remind people about this quick?
This is something we talked about on the show a few weeks ago now. At this point, the State Department of Health had confirmed that Eastern equine encephalitis, which is a mosquito-borne illness, had been found in horses in 8 counties in upstate New York. And that was alarming because while the virus can't jump from horses to humans, mosquitoes can infect humans with it, and it's quite deadly. It has about a 30% fatality rate, and even those people who contract the virus and survive, many of them end up with permanent brain damage. So there had been some other states in the Northeast that had confirmed cases of Eastern equine encephalitis in humans. And of course, we knew it was swirling in the mosquito pool here in New York. And then over the weekend, the first confirmed case in a person was found in Ulster County. And on Monday, that person died. We don't know any details about them at this point. We don't even know their name, their age, whether or not they had any pre-existing conditions. But again, like, it's, you know, the virus on its own is pretty deadly, even to, you know, to healthy people. So that's the situation.
Yeah. And I just wanted to point out for people that, you know, we talked to your colleague, Lana Bellamy, at the beginning of the week to kind of break that news. One of the things that stood out to me in her initial report was that even at the state level, the Department of Health, they're observing that, like, you know, the EEE is something that comes around, but they've never seen it as widespread as this. They said it might pop up in a county or two, but this is covering many counties and now even multiple states. And Department of Health made a point of pointing that out.
Yeah, the Health Department Commissioner James McDonald issued a statement on Monday confirming the death of the Ulster County resident. He said in that statement that normally they see mosquitoes carrying the virus in 2 or 3 counties each year, but as of Monday, they've been found in 15 counties. And even more alarmingly, these counties are spread all across New York State, so it's not like 15 contiguous counties in one portion of the state. So, you know, it seems likely that it's pretty much in mosquitoes across the state. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's been found in horses and in humans in various other states in New England, and I think as far west as Wisconsin. So it's definitely circulating right now. And we have another story that came out this morning that looked at some of the underlying reasons that might be the case. And, you know, the short answer is a warming climate is just good for mosquitoes. And they breed more and they breed faster, and that speeds the spread of mosquito-borne diseases.
Is there anybody, I was just wondering, like, what the sourcing might be for that, or is there any, like, officials or scientists, like, making these observations?
Yeah, so Rick Carlin, who's our business and environmental reporter here at the Times Union, he spoke to a couple of professors at University of Albany, including one who teaches in the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Sciences, and another one who's a professor of biomedical sciences at the college's Integrated Health Sciences Department. And right here in the Hudson Valley, the Carey Institute, which is a scientific research organization, has also been doing a lot of research for years now about mosquito and tick-borne illnesses, and they've noted that that diseases like EEE and also West Nile and other mosquito-borne viruses are just proliferating both faster and in wider geographic areas than previously observed.
You know, anecdotally, I've noticed we've had some winters where we aren't having a hard freeze like we used to. This past winter, we probably got there. The winter before that, maybe not so much. And that affects the insect population. If there isn't ever that hard freeze and more of the insects survive. And as the article that you're talking about here notes, the summer season, which would be the mosquito season, is longer now. They can live for longer.
Yeah, that's right. You know, during dry spells, the mammals and birds where the virus originates, they tend to congregate around water sources, which makes them easier for mosquitoes to feed or to find and to feed upon. The mosquitoes are really the vector of the disease. And, as you mentioned, without that hard freeze, there isn't the die-off that is typically associated with winter. And that, I think in past decades has prevented such a widespread spread of this of these types of diseases.
Yeah, and the cumulative growth of the insect communities. And again, why we're talking about mosquitoes, because even though this is an equine virus, it gets transmitted to people via mosquitoes. And this is why officials are telling people to take all kinds of precautions to try to avoid mosquitoes. Even though we're in October now, people still got to be careful.
Yeah, and our stories have some information about that. That's just straight from the Department of Health and from the CDC, basic sort of tips and tricks, basically, for protecting yourself. It's things that you would expect, basically. Wear long sleeves, wear insect repellent, especially insect repellent with DEET in it, and do things like eliminate standing water from yards and areas around your house.
Yeah, make sure you got screens in your windows, things like that. So be on the lookout for mosquitoes, because this actually is going around. And I know if there are further developments, you'll bring them to us. And I'm hoping that there aren't many further developments.
Me too. Yeah.
Next up, you've got a big story following up on the assistant DA, former assistant DA in Orange County. And we've been talking about this over the last couple months, but you said it took a wild turn this week.
Well, this is. Yes, we have been talking about the Orange County District Attorney's Office, but that's mostly been in relation to their work on the Megan McDonald murder investigation. This is a separate story, and it's a little bit complicated, so strap in. But basically, for a couple of months now, we have been investigating a now former assistant district attorney who had previously also been an Orange County judge, named Stuart Rosenwasser. And we had heard that he was facing bribery allegations related to a theft and embezzlement case that he investigated and prosecuted just last year. This case kind of broke open about a month ago when an Orange County lawmaker said on the radio, on public radio no less, that various agencies within the county, including the county itself, Orange County District Attorney's Office, the DA, and a couple of assistant DAs, including Rosenwasser, had been served notices of claim, which is basically a standard step before filing a lawsuit detailing these bribery allegations. And the long and short of that story is that in 2022 and then running into 2023, Rosenwasser had prosecuted a $1.9 million embezzlement case against the victim in that case was a man named Marty Sudani. And he was alleging that his sister and her son, his nephew, had stolen in or embezzled these funds from him. The charges against the sister were later dropped, but the nephew ended up pleading guilty to grand larceny. Open and shut case seemed like all kosher. Well, what has been revealed since then is text messages and checks between the text messages were between Marty Soudani, the victim in the embezzlement case, and ADA Rosenwasser. And the checks were from Soudani to Rosenwasser. All but one of them was signed and cashed. And they basically outline a bribery scheme. So, you know, the victim in this case was paying the prosecutor. All of this was revealed in a separate legal filing in federal court by the victim's sister, against whom the charges had been dropped. She was accusing him of sexual abuse. And Marty Soudani countersued, and that countersuit opened up an avenue of discovery process, right? And it was in that discovery process that all these text messages and checks came out. So this looked pretty bad for Stuart Rosenwasser, who quietly resigned from the district attorney's office in June. And I say quietly because he sent an email to the DA, David Hubler, that morning saying he was retiring effective immediately. And the DA's office made no public announcement about that, despite the fact that Rosenwasser had a long history in jurisprudence in Orange County and in Rockland County. You know, I mentioned that he had been a judge. He previously served in the district attorney's office under a previous DA. And the DA's office normally celebrates the people who retired. Rosenwasser was actually just named the Arson Investigator of the Year by National Arson Investigators Association last year for prosecuting an arson in Newburgh. So that alone was fishy. We had also heard rumors that we were not able to confirm for our investigation that Rosenwasser was being looked at by the FBI. And we didn't really know what for. But the FBI had showed up to his house to raid it and to interview him in June. And we now think that was probably a day or two before he abruptly retired. The reason I'm saying this now, even though we weren't able to confirm it for our story, is because yesterday, the same morning that our lengthy investigation was published, the FBI went to Stuart Rosenwasser's house in Campbell Hall in the town of Hamptonburg to execute an arrest warrant. And they got into a gunfight, and a law enforcement source tells us that at that point, Rosenwasser fired a few shots at FBI agents and then turned the weapon on himself and took his own life. This was just a few hours after our story came out, but the FBI was executing a search warrant or an arrest warrant on an indictment that they had filed in federal court just yesterday for the bribery, the same bribery scheme that we had previously reported on. They claim that they had basically all the same details that we had, but they claimed that he had accepted $63,000 in bribes and that he had also filed false financial disclosure forms and lied to them when they raided his home back in June. So this was a huge development in that story yesterday, of course.
Yeah, my goodness.
And and really a distressing story. The timing of our big investigation coming out on the same day that the FBI went to arrest this man was completely coincidental, of course, but it's still kind of something shocking to deal with. There's going to be some fallout from this. The indictment that the FBI filed in federal court was actually sealed. But then after yesterday's events, the FBI unsealed it, and or the court unsealed it after the FBI filed a motion to do so. And so that's where we have really all the details of the FBI's investigation. So a really distressing story, as I said. And at this point, nobody's really commenting much on it at all. The district attorney's office hasn't issued a statement. The county itself hasn't issued a statement. The FBI has only said that there was a officer involved shooting. They haven't even confirmed necessarily that Rosenwasser died, but we have several sources with direct and indirect knowledge of what happened there. And we were on the scene for some of the investigation after the exchange of gunfire yesterday morning.
Wow, this is big news, and I'm wondering. Well, first off, just to clarify, like you were looking into this story for months at the Times Union. Was the story that came out yesterday the first product of all of that investigation, or was it one in a series?
No, it was the first. We ended up publishing two stories yesterday. The first one was the lengthy investigation we'd been working on for a while. And then, 6 hours later, that story came out at 6 a.m. Five or 6 hours later, we had a story about what went down when the FBI right. showed up at his house.
And I mean, that must all be coincidence. I mean, the FBI must have been planning to go there before your story went out that morning, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They had filed the indictment. Yesterday. The day before they showed up. So, certainly, we had reached out to Rosenwasser several times. He knew that we were looking into him. There have been other reports in local newspapers, nothing as extensive as what we had done, but, news of these allegations was beginning to circulate. And, we'd also heard, as I mentioned, that the FBI was looking at him. So we reached out to them for comment as well. And they, the FBI's policy basically is to never confirm the existence of an investigation if it's open. It's just a total coincidence.
What are, and if you can talk to this, what do you think are the implications for the district attorney's office in Orange County or, the county itself?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mentioned that this started for us anyway with these notices of claim, which are a step before a lawsuit. The mother and son, the son again, who was convicted in the embezzlement case, they were seeking damages, I think, to the tune of $22.5 million. And I also noted that Rosenwasser himself was not the only person served a notice of claim. In that notice of claim, they say that while they blamed Rosenwasser, gave him the most blame for accepting the bribes, they had made the district attorney's office aware of a conflict of interest between Rosenwasser and Marty Soudani. Rosenwasser had represented Soudani back in the 90s in a series of real estate transactions, and appears to have misled the district attorney's office about that. The district attorney's office nevertheless appointed him to prosecute this case. There's a chance that that case goes forward, or it goes forward in some kind of altered capacity. There are also going to be questions about the district attorney, David Hoover, himself. He rehired Rosenwasser. When he hired Rosenwasser, he appointed him to lead the conviction integrity unit. In an irony of all ironies, and they go way, way back. They used to run a private law practice together, and Rosenwasser, has been involved in some capacity in some of the investigation into the Megan McDonald case. So certainly it's anytime a district attorney's office or any sort of prosecutorial body ends up hiring a senior level official who turned out allegedly to have been committing criminal offenses on the side, that's going to raise questions about the prosecutorial body itself. And, at this moment, they're not answering any of them, but that's a fodder for future investigations.
Absolutely. Well, that's a lot of news and a lot of information. And Philip, believe it or not, we still have more news to get to, but I have to take a break. Can you be able to stay with us and get to more news after the break?
Sure thing.
Okay, so we're going to do that now. Do stay with us, because when we come back, We'll talk about the proposed waste-to-energy facility in Sullivan County with Phil Pantuso of the Times Union. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
To really understand what was happening, we called hundreds of people. And they outlined this pretty elaborate system at Acadia to get as many patients in the door and then keep those patients, especially the ones with insurance, in Acadia facilities for as long as possible.
I'm Katrin Benhold. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. October 26th is the last day to register to vote for the general election in New York State. Applications must be submitted in person, online, or by mail no later than October 26th. Election Day is November 5th. In-person early voting takes place in the 9 days prior to Election Day. And in New York, any registered voter may apply for a mail-in ballot. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. We're talking to Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley Bureau, Times Union. And Philip, so you've got some info on this proposed waste-to-energy facility that I've heard about in Sullivan County.
Yeah, so Roger Hennigan-Gilson reported on this story. So, you know, the county is putting together a local solid waste management plan, as all counties have to do. Sullivan County has actually not had one for 13 years. The last plan covered a period that expired in 2010. And so this new plan is a 10-year plan that will start whenever it's approved and run for the next 10 years. And it lays forth, well, first of all, some background is kind of necessary here. At the moment, Sullivan County trucks its waste to Seneca Meadows Landfill, which is up in the Finger Lakes. It's the biggest landfill in New York, and there are a number of counties in the Hudson Valley that take their waste up there. Currently, Seneca Meadows is seeking a permit from the state to expand because it's running out of room, but there is a whole separate fight happening about that, and it's unclear whether or not the state will grant that permit. So the counties that take their trash up to Seneca Meadows and are working on new solid waste management plans are looking at alternative options. One of those, of course, is Sullivan County. So they released a draft plan, which includes a lot of suggestions for making garbage disposal more environmentally friendly, including expanding a countywide composting program. And it also suggests three feasibility studies on new ways to dispose of the county's garbage. One of those would be to construct a waste-to-energy facility. So waste-to-energy facilities basically break down garbage through a combustion process, which then produces energy that the facility stores. Usually, without getting too complicated, because there's like different technologies for how these work, it essentially turns it into ash, which can then be packaged into different sort of forms of like energy fuel, essentially. Those kinds of facilities have long been criticized by environmentalists for being polluting because the combustion process itself is quite polluting. You know, most environmentalists will say that these are really just incinerators that contaminate the air, the water, and the soil around it with toxic materials. There's been a lot of scientific research that essentially backs that up. You know, for most of these waste-to-energy facilities, the combustion process itself is not green-powered.
Take a lot of – I mean, they're calling it waste-to-energy, but if you're talking about burning things, that takes energy.
Yeah, it does. particularly if you're talking about burning trash, you know, that – a lot of it will burn up into ash, right? But that also releases tons of toxic chemicals. So, yeah, really good environmental reasons for opposing this thing. You know, it is just one option that is named in this feasibility study, but environmentalists in Sullivan County are concerned because the county manager, Josh Potosik, seems to maybe be leaning toward it. He and other county legislators toured an incinerator in Nassau County on Long Island earlier this year, and in his county newsletter, Potosik wrote that the facility, quote, opened our eyes to the possibilities. So, you know, that led environmentalists to believe that the county really may be leaning toward this solution. It's also probably the easiest thing to do because, you know, it would be an outside company that comes in and essentially like bids for this contract. So there's kind of a public comment process happening right now. And that's going until October 15th. And those public comments will then become part of the draft waste management plan.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And finally, I know you have a story about nurse practitioners.
Yeah. So a lawsuit filed last week in U.S. District Court in the Northern District up in Albany against the State Civil Service Commission alleges that nurse practitioners employed by the state of New York have long been underpaid based on this gender, based on their gender. Sorry. This is a class action lawsuit. It's got six named plaintiffs, but it's filed on behalf of more than 200 nurse practitioners employed across multiple state agencies who are overwhelmingly women. They say that they have long performed work that should be more highly compensated. And due to sort of technical reasons pertaining to the state's civil classification system, they allege that they are blocked from advancing further than a particular grade classification, which devalues their education and training and makes them subject to lower compensation than their male counterparts. So, you know, we'll see what happens with this lawsuit, but it's just another indication, really, of the difficulty right now that I think a lot of, particularly wage workers in the healthcare industry, are going through.
All right. Well, Philip, there was a lot of news today. And I mean, it's a lot of news every day when you're in the news business, but I really appreciate the time that you took to explain all of this to us. So thank you so much.
You got it. Take care.
And just a reminder that all those stories that we talked about with Philip Pantuso, they are up now at timesunion.com. It's timesunion.com. And speaking of the times, it's about that time. It's the end of Local Edition. Thank you so much for being here with me. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Do remember that tomorrow morning our election coverage on Radio Catskill continues, and we have a special presentation of the Catskills News and Mid-Hudson News Decision 2024 debate for the New York State 100th Assembly District. It was recorded at Bold Gold Studios at the Liberty Theater there, and it debuted on their stations this past Sunday. You'll be able to hear it tomorrow morning at 11 in place of The World. Again, that's the Catskills News, Mid-Hudson News, Decision 2024 debate for the New York State 100th Assembly District, featuring candidates Lou Ingracia Jr. and Paula Kay. So you don't want to miss that. This time tomorrow evening on the Local Edition, Patricio Rubio will be here with you. Coming up next, we've got Claire in for Ramble Tamble at 7. But before that, there's more news. Don't miss The Daily coming up next. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and PR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to wjffradio.org and click on